The view opens to ocean and a massive gash as we head steeply up. I live for the ups and fly through the maze, my walking sticks like arm extensions, feeling and feeding me forward. But just then, I get that gassy feeling in my chest, the sign my SVT is coming on.
Oh,
not now. It immediately sets my heart beating wildly.
It's the damn SVT.
My breath seems fine, long ins and out, yet slightly gaspy. And I feel leaden and dizzy. And yet, even with supraventricular tachycardia, she persists. I walk slowly, inch by inch, until Ted finally suggests stopping before the wind gets wild at the top. I agree with him and take a beta blocker sitting on a rock, and then I inch along some more. SVT is awful. I'm weak, fainty, I can't breathe. But it's not fatal. I mean, unless I faint and fall off a cliff. So this determined girl muscles on and crests the summit, knowing downhill will at least keep her from heavy breathing. And the beta blocker works as we wobble our way from one tussocky bit to the next, spot on back to the third sign along the barbed wire fence, across the burn, across the fence, then up some more, down, up again, and across. You're listening to the Blissful Hiker podcast. I'm Allison Young, the Blissful Hiker, sometime professional flutist, sometime voice artist, and full-time pedestrian. Thanks so much to Lecky Trekking Poles and Belega Socks for their support. Also Summit Orthopedics in the Twin Cities, my choice for two total hip replacements. My goal in sharing stories of walking long-distance trails as a solo, female, middle-aged, titanium-reinforced hiker is to empower you to learn to hike your own hike, too. I'm nervous about this stage of the Cape Wrath Trail. We cross several rivers, including two that are said to be dangerous in spate. Everything is in spate right now with all this rain, although the last 2 days have been gloriously dry. We pack for extra nights, intending a bothy stay near Sand Bay. It's a bit off-trail, but said to be an interesting place, once home to a hermit nicknamed Sandy. Sheep dot the landscape, both black and white. It's windy and gray, and I put on an extra layer plus my raincoat, which I promptly remove as we begin to walk. It's only 4 miles to the bay, an easy walk on track in an area maintained by the John Muir Trust. Large, fancifully shaped mountains appear with cottony clouds attached as we pass Lochans. This is the time to see just how long we can keep our feet dry before we have to step into a burn or a bog. The sun is silvery through cloud, and I think about the wind and how the BBC Weather Service designated its speed. Yesterday was a gentle breeze, whereas the day before was moderate. Today, it's a fresh breeze. And I soon realize fresh is actually more powerful than moderate. I don't know what's after that. Gale? The place is lonely and quiet, but that's not its history. Many people lived here, a dead giveaway, the skeleton of a stone building, but they were forcibly removed to make way for sheep. We see two people coming towards us with packs and swinging arms. They've camped at the bay and are headed back before it rains. We can see ahead where the cliffs open to the bay, making it here in record time. This may be a home to sheep, but it's also protected for scientific interest. Its extensive dunes make it one of the most species-rich and least disturbed places in all of Scotland. The name Sandwood Bay comes from the Norse, describing the quality of a nearby loch. We don't see much life at this time of year, but marvel at the deep sand and grasses we need to pass through, digging in deep with each step before we reach the beach itself. One of the most iconic sea stacks rises straight and proud at the end of the beach. The rocks here are pretty special too, part of ancient gneiss squeezed into colorful layers. These are obvious underfoot at our first river crossing on palm-sized stones smoothed by the water's relentless tumbling. I'm taken with the reflection of the sky, gray and silver, in pools on the sand, as well as the light turquoise as waves curl up in the dim light. We snap pictures and I collect a few shells, including a massive limpet. Without discussing it too much, we decide it's far too early to stop and better to head all the way to the Cape. We have the time, but we're warned the 8 miles is a slog across utterly trackless, peaty moorland, remote and tough going, with the North Atlantic throwing all it's got at you. Nonetheless, we're surprised not to find any hint of herd trail, and the ones we do find take us off in the wrong direction. Our first challenge is straight up a hill, stepping up strongly with the help of walking sticks on tussocky and mossy lumps. The view is outstanding, and we see one hill after another leading to the Cape. What comes up must go straight down, every step carefully negotiated through mud and squishy fluorescent green moss. Our shoes are totally wet from the first river, so neither of us cares anymore where we step. The rain returns a misty drizzle. The ocean is lapis under brooding skies. We charge on, looking vainly for any hint of trail, moving confidently to the first river. I'm nervous, telling myself we can always turn back or walk to the Bothy if need be. Ted spots a loud waterfall, and the knot just grows in my stomach. Just because we can get through doesn't mean we can get back. I push upstream and find rocks in line that might work. But when Ted tests one with a pole, it's slippery with gooey algae. So I move even further upstream to find a braid with a sandy bottom. Perfect! I can even step from one island to the next without submerging too deeply. Ted just splashes straight across, and I realize that even with one more foot of water, this should be an easy cross back. It seems we're spot on the route, but heading upstream throws off our bearings, and we contour too low and slightly west rather than north. A compass bearing doesn't seem to help, and we end up having to create a sharp edge to find the tiny opening between two lochans. This is when I start to panic a bit, as we leap from one tussocky island to another around deep bogs. I wonder if we'll get out here safely. It's not easy walking at all, but rather movements that twist, stretch, and pull at your legs, requiring balance and strength to keep moving. And it's steep here as I try to pull us closer to our route, up a lonely and desolate hill filled with deep, peaty pools. At the top, I look down towards a ravine where I know our second river lies. I take a bearing on a gash in the mountain ahead and start walking overland towards it. At no time does it feel easy, but I'm scared of how long this is taking us. Ted tells me if we want to turn back, it's now or never. I'm certain of the direction and determined to get over the next river, so I plow through, oftentimes finding one bit of grass above eroded bog to cross. It takes us to a fence. We're entering now the MOD, Ministry of Defense, live firing range. It's a good thing we checked first that no one is shooting today. It's an awkward climb over barbed wire. Someone helpfully affixed thick wire as a handhold and some posts to climb on, but we still need to take off our packs and hurl them over before we carefully climb over. But that's only the beginning of our challenge. The river is deep in that ravine, with access itself a challenge. The water tumbles and boils over rocks, and I can't imagine trying to keep my balance while crossing. So again, I walk up the river, and sure enough, I find a way over a flatter spot where I step on big, shifty stones. Can I get back here if it rains and rises? Yes. I look back at the spot and make a mental note of the number of signs on the fence so I can find my cross if the weather gets ugly. Up we go again, steeply on lumpy ground, We're breathing heavy, heading towards a pointy hat of a peak that we contour around. Somehow I take us slightly too far east, and we end up having to negotiate 3 deep gashes in the mountain, dropping in and crossing small streams, then crawling out again. We get to the top of a hill and can see our final hill in the distance, and a road. This is right before a cloud of rain comes for us, thankfully at our backs, spitting and blowing. We drop fast back into holes, this time all created by ordnance. It's wet and it's miserable, and our view completely disappears. An odd and fitting end to this wild trail. I'm feeling strong and not at all cold, but it's bleak here, and I'm not sure how much more I have in me. Just then, we see a figure coming our way. It's Alberto from Glencool. He greets us with a smile, telling us he camped at Sandwood Bay last night and will again tonight. Boy, he's a tough guy, handling this both ways in one day. It cheers the mood as we contour another massive ravine. Ted's certain he's found a footpath, only to have it disappear under our feet. It's more of this wet, lumpy, exhausting business, beautiful in its own drear way, before we hop up a hill and hit road. Ted sets out to build a cairn just as the sky clears and the sun comes out. The landscape is beautiful in sunlight, bright and more varied in color. We move quickly around, looking back to islands and steep cliffs, the sun actually hot. We're high up with the ocean completely inaccessible. 2 cargo ships move slowly past. When the lighthouse comes into view, I holler. The northwesternmost point in the UK, no land between here and home. The light is lovely, recently painted white and light brown. Signs tell us that it was built in 1828 by Robert Stevenson, part of a dynasty of lighthouse builders, and Robert Louis Stevenson's grandfather. It's thought that when the younger Stevenson came to this wildly lonely place, it inspired him to write Treasure Island. The place is strategic and goes back to the Norse, who used it as a turning point where they'd head east toward home. Wrath is an appropriate name, even in this sunshine, knowing there's little that separates the elements from my helpless self. The area is in a state of refurbishing, with one lone building the only one that appears habitable. It's the Ozone, a cafe, and our home for the night. Ted called last night to see if it was open, but the place appears empty, even with an open 24-hour sign. We look around and take pictures, but we're cold and decide to claim bunks and change out of our wet socks. The dorm is accessed through a machine shop filled with stacked wood, but it's lovely inside, clean and bright with crisp white sheets. We set up, and still no one comes. Ted nervous now that we have no water. We take a walk to the signal house above, also a work in progress, all boarded up with warning signs that walls might collapse. I find a stream running through the peat, and we find water that we collect, all root beer colored. We make dinner in the cafe, finishing just as it goes dark and the lighthouse begins its nightly routine. Still no one here when the mist closes in and the wind picks up, moaning and whistling. I only hope the mist is just a sprinkle and squeezes everything out of the sky before tomorrow and our return. You're listening to the Blissful Hiker Podcast. In a series of personal essays coupled with found sound and my own flute playing, this podcast explores my journey of self-discovery as a middle-aged woman, sharing the sometimes unglamorous but vital truth about empowerment as badass people who don't need permission to blaze our own trails in this journey we call life. The moaning of the wind stops sometime in the middle of the night with brilliant pink lighting the sky. The air is warm, still, and humid. I see squalls far out at sea, Deer run in herds above the shattered countryside. There's no way out of here in off-season. The ferry at the end of the road would normally take a walker to Durness. But all that's stopped now, so the only way out is walking back the way we came. It's so nice to walk on road. Our stomach's full, and we can see the sea stack from here and even a bit of beach. Wouldn't it be lovely just to march there on this track? But no, a sharp turn into utter clag begins at the rock cairn, and off we go, faster now, seeing exactly where we need to contour. That doesn't remove the challenge of foot placement, the ankle always turning on shifting ground of moss mounds and general swishiness. I fall down deep into a hole opening like a trap door, then sink both legs to the upper thigh in muck. The rain comes in spurts, but the wind is less. Ted tells me after fresh breeze comes strong. It's more like a refreshing fan now, and we're cruising through this challenging bit, often splitting off as we choose different routes. It's our hardest 2 days, especially with all the rain, but by far the best, because we're both strong and evenly matched. A middle-aged woman with 2 new hips, and a retired ultramarathoner unafraid of this wild terrain, and maybe motivated because it's so wild and unknown. We finally reach the beach and find the slippery stones as the lock pours into the sea. Loads of people have arrived as we walk out, surprised it feels so far. We march at full speed, and I tease Ted that his son is concerned he won't be fit enough for their next race a few days after I leave. Just as we pass the last lock-in before the houses come into view, the rain really starts to pour. No longer a passing shower, but settling in. And look what we did, heading all the way out and back, pushing hard and returning in the nick of time. We both feel, as they say in these parts, chuffed. When Bill Bryson wrote his landmark book, A Walk in the Woods, chronicling his misadventures on the Appalachian Trail, he summarized events by saying, "We walked it," even though they completed about 1/3 of the actual mileage. His reasoning was they indeed walked and experienced the route and all the harsh weather it could dole out, with big climbs to summits that offered zero views and with oftentimes quirky people. After 700 miles, it was enough, and they moved on to other things. In our case, the weather was so horrendous we simply couldn't keep moving forward in the usual way. But somehow, we walked around 170 miles or so, missing our target of 230. Still, that's an achievement considering the trip was on the precipice of being axed entirely. It also had the benefit of forcing creative thinking to choose the best spots to walk, and a willingness to let go when the going got so tough it made no sense to keep plowing forward. It's unlike me to quit, but calculated misery afforded challenges rather than a death march, and plenty of stories to share, as well as experience gained. I learned about disappointment and coming to terms with the fact that things don't always work out as you planned, that you often have to improvise, and that holding too tightly to a given itinerary will, in the end, frustrate and keep you from enjoying what is possible. As a peak-bagging kind of gal, it certainly isn't easy to let go of a goal. But oddly, this walk opened up new avenues in my perception of what success looks like. And for that, I'm tremendously grateful. You can subscribe to Blissful Hiker wherever you get your podcasts. And do leave a review on Apple to help the show get discovered. Blissful Hiker is on Patreon right now. Find a link to Patreon in the show notes or at blissfulhiker.com. You can also see pictures, listen to other episodes, read the blog, and contact me. Just go to blissfulhiker.com. We've come to the end of Season 2 of Blissful Hiker, and it's time to take a pause and get ready for the upcoming season of hikes. The Arizona Trail is on the list, as is the high route of the Wind River Range. But who knows what opportunities will arise. And for now, it's a whole lot of walking on ice and snow in my favorite parks in Minnesota, getting stronger and building an appetite for the next walk. Do keep in touch and let me know what you're walking. And until we meet again, my friends, kia kaha and happy trails.